Thanks very much for coming to my talk. So I'm an experimentalist, and I'm going to tell you about some a setup that I'm building at the Institute for Quantum Computing, not too far from here. And that setup would be a cold atom experiment based on cold, laser-cooled trapped ions. And my goal in this talk is, you know, since I think most of the audience is theorists here, I'd like to keep it very broad and basically give you a sense of what kind of things are possible in this experiment and what are the strengths and what's hard. So hopefully that would, you know, motivate at least some of you to think more about what kind of experiments can be done using these systems. And I'm available after my talk, and also I'm, you know, very nearby. So I'd happy to have some, you know, discussions, maybe even some collaboration in the future. So just to give you a very brief introduction of what is it that we are trying to do in our experiment community. So we know that a lot of questions, open problems in modern physics involve understanding strongly correlated systems that are strongly interacting with each other. And we see those systems at various energy scales, right? So high temperature superconductors, or, you know, when you collide two ions in a, or two, you know, particles in a collider experiment just after the collision. So these are all examples of systems that are strongly interacting with each other. And as physicists, we want to understand what's the minimal description at the level of, you know, microscopic, minimal model that we can write down that captures or predicts this macroscopic phenomena that we can observe experimentally. Or we can also ask this problem kind of in a reverse way, and we can say, okay, let's say as an experimentalist, I know everything about a spin, or I know everything about a single atom. So here, let's say, you know, I have a spin, and I know how to control it, I know how it behaves, I even know how two spins interact with each other, like everything, or how two atoms interact with each other. And then I put a bunch of them together. So I ask, what kind of quantum phases do we expect from such a system, such a many-body system, right? So it's basically the same kind of, you know, problem, but in two different ways. Now, as we know that most often than not, we don't have access to analytical methods to solve these quantum many-body problems. So we try to simulate these quantum systems on computers, or classical computers. And the problem is, of course, that in quantum mechanics, the quantum superposition, we have to, you know, use the quantum superposition, and so the, you know, Hilbert space that's exponential in the system size becomes unmanageable on normal computers. And it's precisely unmanageable because in most of these strongly interacting systems, you have entanglement, right? So, you know, this is a classic example of entanglement where you have, you know, the so-called singlet state between two spins. No matter which axis you are measuring it, the spins are anti-correlated to each other, both in X and Y and Z. So it's a very non-classical system. And there is no way to write down this system as kind of, you know, product of two individual spins. And in a quantum many-body system, entanglement grows beyond nearest neighbor particle and two particles, and it could be as big as the system size, you know, the number of particles that are entangled with each other. And that's the problem with simulating these systems on a computer. Of course, there are theorists here, and some of them are in the audience, who try to come up with, you know, the best possible approximation to approximate a complicated many-body state into, you know, something that is not, that doesn't have to, you know, take into account the whole Hilbert space. And so there is progress going on in the theoretical front as well. But if you want to solve, let's say, a two-level system, a bunch of two-level systems exactly on a computer, I think you are limited to about 30 to 40 spins. That's how much computing power you have currently. So Feynman was addressing this problem in 1980s, and he was talking about how you can simulate quantum physics on computers exactly. And his suggestion was, let the computer itself be built of quantum mechanical elements. So at least the quantum registers, or the, you know, our computing elements, would have the laws of quantum mechanics inbuilt into the system. And then there are lots of foundational work by people that showed that indeed you can, you know, theoretically, you can build a quantum simulator, so-called the universal quantum simulator, using quantum objects. So how does it, how would it look like experimentally? So we need, just like, you know, classical registers bits, we need some components, some experimental bits or qubits, or you can call them your the spins, spin halves, for example. So this is an example that I will come back for, you know, most of the talk later, which is, let's say I have, you know, a vacuum chamber, and inside that there is an ion trap. Now this is a very useful apparatus because I can trap individual atoms. These are charged atoms, ions, in these. And this is a very well-controlled quantum system. They are levitated in vacuum, and I can manipulate a lot of properties of these quantum systems, and I'll go in detail later. So within each of these, you know, atoms or ions, I can define a qubit, or I can define a spin state, spin up and spin down, by looking at, you know, two internal states. It doesn't have to be internal state, could be an external state also, like a positional state, but let's say for internal state. And I also know how to couple two qubits or two spins. We know how to detect. Now this is something very useful. We can detect whether a system is in spin up or spin down, or in qubit one and qubit zero. And because I can couple them, I can sort of dial in a Hamiltonian in the system, in the, you know, language of, let's say, spins, for example. And I let the system solve for this Hamiltonian. So the system will basically find out maybe a ground state of some kind of Hamiltonian, quantum Hamiltonian. Or it can even look at like dynamics of some Hamiltonian. So that's kind of the goal. Now, if you already had a perfectly functioning big quantum computer, then in principle you can probably solve all these problems. But we don't have a quantum computer yet. So people are trying to build these special purpose quantum computers, also known as quantum simulators, using a variety of hardware platforms. So some of the platforms are atomic system based. So for example, this trapped ion, or neutral atoms in optical lattices, or molecules, for example. And some of the platforms are solid state devices. So for example, the superconducting circuits, and there are, you know, a lot of people working on these systems at IQC, or photonic networks, or even, you know, defect systems in solid state material like, you know, diamond or silicon. So one observation is that these different systems are good for different things. So because we don't have a universal quantum computer or a universal quantum simulator yet, they have their strengths. So certain models are easier on one system and harder on the other system. So in this talk, I'll specifically be focusing on the atomic systems. And to give you a flavor of why I'm so excited about the atomic systems and what distinguishes this system from other solid state systems. So one thing is, all the atomic qubits are basically identical. That's a gift from the nature, right? If you are building a qubit made of some solid state device, they're not identical because the property of the qubit itself depends on the surrounding, because they're in a solid surrounded by other stuff around it. But for atomic systems, you know, as long as the fine structure constant doesn't drift in the lab, we're fine. Okay. Now, they are also well isolated from the environment, because they are, you know, levitated in vacuum, and kind of we can shield the radiation, shield, you know, vibration and all those things from the chamber. So they're very well isolated, and that results in a long coherence, long decoherence time in these experiments. Then in the last few decades, people have discovered newer and newer techniques to use lasers to cool down these objects to extreme low temperatures. So we are now approaching a regime where you can cool down a bunch of atoms to like picokelvin type temperature scale. So these are very cold objects, and you know, you have access to that using lasers. And then two extremely useful things is that both the time scales and the like real space scale for these systems are very favorable to do experiments. So in such a system, if you have a Hamiltonian, for example, then all the dynamics is happening roughly at, you know, give an idea, like kilohertz to megahertz timescale. So if you want to observe the quantum dynamics in such a system, your detector has to be only millisecond or maybe microsecond. Now that's something that can be done with current technologies. On the other hand, if you take a chunk of solid, then a lot of things that's happening in the solid material is happening at a much faster timescale. So you don't have, you know, the experimental access to observing those. On the other hand, if you look at real space, so in solid you have atoms that are angstrom apart from each other. Here the atoms in my synthetic system, what I can call, the atoms are microns apart from each other. So you can take an optical microscope and use ordinary light to image single atoms, and you can tell them apart from each other. So that helps you both to detect and to control these systems compared to some of the solid state systems. Okay. So now let's get back to trapped ion. That's what I'm going to talk about in detail. So this is an example of a bunch of ions in a one-dimensional kind of forming a crystal, like a finite-sized crystal here. And this is like a picture on a camera. Right? So you can take pictures of these are individual atoms. Again, the separation between them could be 2 microns. You can vary the separation from, let's say, 1 micron to 10, 20 microns. So you can image them using optical means. And as I said, you can look at the individual states and define your qubit states or spin states. Okay. Now, it's not enough to just define the states. You should be able to initialize the states very perfectly. And you can do that in this system. I'll show you how later. But perhaps the most interesting feature for me is how many types of interactions you can engineer in these systems, right? So these are ions. So you would say that by default, I just have Coulomb interactions. But now Coulomb interaction, it's interesting, but you cannot turn it off because the charge is always on, right? So I'll show you later that we use this Coulomb interaction to effectively engineer interaction between the spin degrees of freedom or the qubit degrees of freedom. And we can engineer a bunch of different Hamiltonians, starting from quantumizing XY, XYZ, and we can control the interaction strength, the range, and the sign of those Hamiltonian, of the interactions in the same system, like using, just changing a bunch of frequency in the laboratory. And we can create local magnetic fields and all. So these systems have extremely long quantum coherence. So just to give you an idea, the longest quantum coherence shown in an isolated trapped ion system is about 15 minutes. Okay, so that's quite macroscopic for a system of quantum. So you can create a pi pulse, for example, then go have a coffee and come back, and still you have the quantum coherence in this system. And you can do that because this is such well isolated from environment. Okay? And it's, in fact, in this long coherence time and this isolated, the fact that it's so isolated also let you build other interesting quantum objects like clocks, for example, atomic clocks. It relies on the fact that you have a very stable system. Okay. Finally, we can detect the spin states. So for example, let's say I'm studying a magnetic system and I would like to know what kind of the magnetic spin correlation I have in my system. So I can design my laser such that if I shine it onto my atoms, if the atom is in spin up, it fluoresces. So if I take an image, it's just bright atom. And if it's spin down, it doesn't do anything. Right? So here, for example, it's taken from one experiment that we have done in this system with 10 ions. And at the end of the experiment, the system showed antiferromagnetic ordering. Right? So we don't have to measure any repeated measurements, correlation functions to see this ordering. It's just a single shot. Take a picture, and this is what you see. So this is spin up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. So it's like a single shot measurement, and you see the correlation. So you can do that, this experiment. Okay. So now that I have described some of the great features of this trapped ion system, now let's see how we can put the ions together and build a quantum simulator here. And please feel free to stop anytime and ask questions. So there are various kinds of ion trap apparatus, and I'm not going to go into detail here for this audience. But the basic idea is you are trying to trap a charged particle. So you don't need light to trap it, unlike neutral atoms. So here you just need a bunch of electrodes. You apply some potential, some voltage, and that creates an electric potential, except there is this fundamental law of nature that you cannot create a three-dimensional minimum using electrostatics alone, because the Laplacian of the potential has to vanish. So you need some radio frequency in it. So you need a time average potential also. But you have some electrodes and you apply those static potential and the radio frequency, and that generates a trapping potential here near the center. And that gives you a nice chain of ions when you are cooling it down. So the way it works is you have, you know, so this is kind of a big vacuum chamber. You can see like this is like a screw. So you kind of get an idea of the scale here. But these electrodes are, you know, hundreds of microns essentially. And then you have a source of atom in the back. And you turn on, you heat up the oven, and that just spits a bunch of atom into this region. And then you turn on a bunch of lasers, which ionizes the atoms, photoionization. And also these lasers cool down using all these laser cooling techniques pioneered by Dave Wineland and Steve Chu and Bill Phillips and all, Quintanaji. And essentially then the ions are getting colder and colder, and at some point the temperature is lower compared to the potential that you have created using all these, you know, electrodes, the electronic potential. And then the ions form a nice looking crystal. So this is like a finite temperature version of Wigner crystal, where it's completely dominated by the interaction, the Coulomb interaction. The reason why it's one dimensional, it's deliberate, because we make the trap very anisotropic. So the trapping potential in this direction is very strong compared to in this direction. So we can have a long chain of ions. And there are some technical reasons why people prefer that, but it could also be two-dimensional. There is nothing that's stopping it from becoming two-dimensional. Okay, and again, it's the internal state within one ion. So the ion that I'm going to choose for my experiment at IQC is ytterbium. So I did not know that there's such an element before I started working with it, because it's quite complicated. It has atomic number of 70. And this is kind of part of the energy level diagram. And this is not to scare you, but to convince you that, to assure you that even if, you know, this is quite a complicated atom, but we know how to control this. Okay, so these are my two spin states, down and up. So the goal is I set all my laser systems such that I know how to keep my system within these two energy states. So if the system falls in one of these energy states, I will have lasers which will quickly pump it back and bring it back here. Okay. And that happens much quicker compared to the experimental time scale. So we are good. So effectively, you know, we just use these two energy states, and the fluorescence that I showed on a camera, on the, you know, the image of the ion, is done on these excited states. So S to P, when we want to image the ion, we just excite, and then it comes back and it emits the blue photon, the ultraviolet photon at 370, and which is what we image. The experiments are expensive because working with ultraviolet is a pain. Okay, so I mentioned a few strong points of this atomic system, and I want to go over them slowly to kind of give you a flavor of how we actually initialize the spin states to spin down. For example, so one thing to keep in mind, and especially for solid-state physics community, this might not be too obvious, is that these are hyperfine energy states of atoms. So there is no natural relaxation mechanism. That means if I prepare my system in spin up, it's not going to go down to spin down in any finite time. This lifetime is pretty much infinite, right? Because these are protected by nuclear spin flips. These are hyperfine states. So if I prepare a spin here, it's going to stay there. I have to do something to flip it down to spin down state. So what do? I basically turn on some laser, which is precisely tuned to, you know, this is S and P, the atomic states. And the trick here is if the spins are excited here, with some probability it will get down to this low state, which is my spin down. Of course, it can come down to the up spin state. But once it gets down to spin down, there is nothing that takes it out from there, because there is no light that pumps it back from here to one of the excited states. So after scattering a few photons on an average, it gets stuck there, right? So we can prepare, no matter what the excited state, what the initial state is, it's either spin up or even these other states, which are not part of my Hamiltonian, Hilbert space, within a few microseconds, with probability 99.9%, let's say I can bring it down to spin down. So it's a perfect initialization. And like, you know, the NMR techniques, right? So MRI machine, to polarize spins, even like a PPM level polarization, you need to apply huge, like some 4 Tesla, 5 Tesla magnetic field there. You don't need any of that. You just turn on a laser, and then within a microsecond, you polarize the system almost completely, 100% polarization. Okay, that's the power of the system, because you're doing it optically. Okay, now I also showed you that pictures where you can detect the spin state, whether it's spin up or spin down. How do you do that? Again, by selecting what transition I'm exciting in the system. So let's say I have spin up or spin down, and if the system is in spin up state, I excite, I just turn on a laser which is precisely tuned to this exciter state. Okay, so the spin goes up, and then it comes back, spontaneous emission, right? It emits a bunch of photon. But the crucial point here is that because of forbidden rules, Fermi's golden rule and all, forbidden transitions, the spin never falls back to down state. Okay, that's a forbidden state. So if I spin up, it comes down, and then I can keep the light on, it goes up and comes down, and I can collect many, many, many photons without ever mixing my spin up and spin down. So if I collect the number of photons in about a millisecond, I will see many, many photons, for example, Poisson distribution emitted photon. On the other hand, if the atom is in spin down, the same light, the same frequency doesn't do anything because now it's off resonant by this 2.6 gigahertz. So the atom doesn't absorb the light, and there's no fluorescence coming from the atom. And hence we can take a picture like what I've shown you. If the spin is in up, then we see it's like a bright glowing, and if it's down, it doesn't do. And we can do this imaging with, again, more than 99% perfection. Okay, so now I talked about the initialization and how we detect the images. Now let's see how we can do, we can manipulate spins at the level of single atom and how we engineer the interactions, the Hamiltonian here. So again, I have a bunch of atoms, and let's say I want to flip the spin of this particular ion from down to up. So what I want to do is just bring in a radiation field. It could be a microwave, or it could be standing wave created by two laser beams. Whatever, I bring in a radiation field where I tune the frequency to be exactly equal to the qubit frequency. Then it's an on-resonant system, and the spin goes up. And if I keep it on, then it will basically coherently flop between spin down and spin up. So it's a coherent rubby flopping between spin down and spin up, essentially. So that's how I manipulate spin at the level of individual particles. So now here's the interesting part. When we want to study a quantum Hamiltonian or some magnetic model, we want to couple two spins, induce the interaction between the spins. So how do we do it? Now, there is a very little interaction between the spins because they have different magnetic moments, but that interaction is extremely tiny. That's at the level of Hertz, which is very low. So we don't want to do that. We want to engineer an interaction that I can turn off, control. So we do that by using what's common between these two ions, and that is the collective mode of vibration. Because these are ions, and they repel each other, and they are also in this confining potential created by the electrodes of my ion trap. So they have a bunch of vibrational modes, right? And that vibrational mode is what's common between various ions. So this is what I'm gonna do. Let's say I bring in one radiation field where I tune the frequency to be not just the qubit frequency so that it flips the spin, but I tuned it to be qubit frequency plus that one of the vibrational mode frequency, right? So it flips the spin only when there is a creation of phonon at the same time, this vibrational quantum. And now that phonon is basically a common bus, if you say, in like information language between these states. So now this ion, it is also vibrating at that precise frequency. So I can bring in a second frequency where I tune a second radiation field where I tune the frequency to be the qubit frequency minus the vibrational frequency. So then I can flip this spin only when I kill that phonon excitation. So basically I have coupled these two spins by effectively exchanging a phonon, like creating virtually and then destroying at the same time. And you don't have to do it in sequential, you can just turn on a big fat beam with these two frequencies, and then that will couple all the spins effectively by these phonons. And for practical purpose, we don't create the phonons in an on-resonant way because we want a spin excitation. So that's done kind of like a virtual phonon excitation. So these transitions are a little off-resonant from the phonon excitation. So in this simple model where I started with two spin downs and I flipped them both up, that is essentially what an Ising model does, right? It's a transverse Ising model, sigma x that flips the two spins up with a strength that I can control by controlling the strength of my laser beams by radiation fields and a few other things that I'll describe in the next slide.
Sorry. Yes. These are probably very stupid questions. These are especially separated.
Yes.
So
these are, right, so that's very important. So because these are charged particles, right, these collective vibrational modes are basically long range, right? So if I have So I'll show you in the next slide. If I have, let's say if I am exciting a center of mass motion, center of mass phonon, then there is no concept of who is nearest neighbor and who is farthest from each other. They're all taking part equally.
But you did the local excitation.
That's right. So local excitation is in spin. Right? But it is exciting. I tune the field such that it is exciting the phonon spectrum. Yeah. So it is, so the excitation spin is local, but the vibrational state is global. Okay. So a little bit more about this phonon modes, because that's what gives this system such richness in terms of what you can do, the interactions. So here what I'm doing is, instead of just turning on one radiation field, I'm just bringing in two laser beams and I'm changing the frequency of one of them. So essentially I'm changing the frequency of the beat note, which is the radiation field that I'm talking about. So here, for some frequency of the beat note between the two optical fields, I just flip the spins. In technical language, you know, in our community, they're known as the carrier transition. Forget about that. So I say this is just flipping the spin without ever touching other, you know, any phonon states. But then I have a bunch of motional modes. So for n ions in three dimension, I have 3n normal modes, n normal modes in each direction. And the axial normal modes, they are kind of equidistant from each other. The farthest, like the highest frequency normal mode is the zigzag mode, and the slowest frequency normal mode is the center of mass, where they all move together. And then, so this is, you know, all the ions are vibrating along their axis, called axial direction. And then in the transverse direction, turns out that for this Coulomb system, it's the center of mass mode that's actually the highest frequency mode. And all the higher spatial wavelength, higher spatial frequency modes, normal modes, are lower in real energy. So this is some kind of like anomalous dispersion for these kind of phonons in the transverse direction. And similarly, you have another set of those phonons in the other direction going into the board, for example. So I can use any of them, one or multiple, to mediate these spin-dependent interactions. Okay. And so that's the zigzag state. Okay. So without going into the details of how we get this interaction, all these terms, it's, I think, quite intuitive how we can change the interaction strength between two spins. So these omega I and omega j are basically dependent on the power at each spin. So how quickly I'm flipping the spin, the spins at different ions. So it depends on the laser power that I can control in the experiment. So this is the interaction strength between, again, that ion and that ion, for example. And then, of course, some fundamental constants depending on the mass of the ion and all, and the momentum of the radiation field that gets into here, sets the basic time scale. And this is super important. So these BIK and BJK are the eigenfunction of the mode. So what normal mode of vibration I'm using to mediate the interaction. Because as I explained, if I am using the center of mass mode, then all the ions are taking part equally. And so it doesn't matter if I'm looking at interaction between spin 1 and spin 2 or spin 1 and spin 10, because that mode, there's no difference. So B, that K would denote the mode of spin 1 or spin 10. They're all 1 over n in that case, or 1 normalized, right? And then, of course, I have the laser frequency that I'm tuning in the experiment. And how far are those, is my radiation field from all the normal modes. So that's basically what goes in here. And if I just take this simple equation and change my laser frequency. So I showed you all these normal modes at different energy, different frequencies, and I'm just changing my radiation field frequency. So I'm effectively changing which mode I'm using to mediate these interactions. So this is what I see. So these lines are, again, the normal modes in the transverse direction. If I tune my laser system such that I'm close to the center of mass mode, if I'm exactly on top of the center of mass mode, as I argued, the interaction never falls off with distance. It's all equal, so it's all to all. All the spins interact with equal strength. So in effect, it's an infinite range interaction. But if I just tune my system a little farther from the center of mass mode, then now I have competition from the other modes, because I'm exciting these as well as these as well as the other modes. So the effective interaction will look like the false. So this is an interaction, kind of a bar plot. So this is spin I and spin j, and the z axis is the interaction strength. So I see that all the spins interact with equal strength, sorry, not equal strength, but same sign, but they kind of fall off with distance. And they fall off in some kind of an empirical power law that I can control depending on where I tune my laser frequency. Yeah. But if I go in between other modes, Now I am bringing in the characteristics of other normal modes. So central mass mode, all of them are moving together. But let's say the second mode is where my center, if I had an odd number of ions, then the center ion is stationary, and the chain is doing this, basically. That's the second mode of vibration. So you can imagine from the way I'm engineering the interaction, it's the interaction between the first spin and the last spin that's the strongest. And they're moving because they are taking part the strongest in this normal mode of vibration. And the spins that are near the center, the interaction is pretty much zero there. Okay. Similarly, I have to include the effect from this mode, which gives another character. So if you sum over all, contribution from all the modes, this is where you get the interaction profile. So the long-range interactions are very strong, and they prefer the spins to anti-align from each other, anti-ferromagnetic interaction, because the eigenfunction, because the eigenvector has like a minus sign here. And the short-range interactions are weak and ferromagnetic. So it's a model where the ground state is the domain, is basically spin with domains formation, because the long-range interaction is anti-ferromagnetic and very strong. And your ferromagnetic excitation will be like an excited state here. It's an example. Similarly, you can go to between other models and you can get very complicated and very rich kind of interaction pattern here. It's not quite arbitrary. I'll show you at the end of the talk how we can get to an arbitrary interaction, but still a very rich kind of interaction. So one takeaway point from here is, even though, like I showed you a picture of a 1D chain of ions, this is by no means a 1D system, because you can have control over any pair of interactions. So you can basically redraw that 1D chain into some kind of network, if you wish, network of spins connected by some interaction that you can, in principle, engineer. Okay. So, yeah.
Are you assuming that you are at sufficiently low temperature that the emotional degrees of freedom are all in the ground state?
Right. So that's something that I haven't explained to you. So the way, the cartoon way that I showed, the engineering this interaction is the Sirac-Zoller kind of proposal. There, yes, you have to be very, very cold to the ground state. But if you do it in a Mohr-Sorensen way, so basically global beam and if you're familiar with this, or I can talk about it later, then the result is the spin interaction is to a leading order not dependent on what phonon state you are in, as long as you are pretty close to the ground state. But also, it's not that hard to be in the ground state for this system, because my trap frequency, emotional trap frequency for trapped ion system is very large. It's like 5 megahertz, right? So even with a millikelvin type temperature, which will be very hot for a conventional optical lattice experiment, you are still very much in the ground state because the trap frequency is so large. Right? What would matter though is, while you are doing this experiment, if the system is heating up, if I'm adding energy to the system. So that could be a practical limitation to how long of an experiment you can do in the system. Okay. So this is the control of range of the interactions that I mentioned, which is, if I tune my laser frequency like blue or higher than the center of mass mode, if I'm on the center of mass mode, then the interaction is infinite range, as I argued. But if I move away and away, then the interaction, it's a power law decay of interaction in space. And I can tune the decay constant, the power law exponent, in a continuous fashion from 0 to 3, just by changing the frequency of a laser. So in the same system, I go from an infinite range interaction to dipole interaction by just changing the frequency of a laser. Okay. So now that I explained how we engineer the interactions and the spin Hamiltonian, let's see how a typical experiment will be done. Now, it depends on what experiment you want to do. But here, let me describe what is the so-called adiabatic quantum simulation protocol, right? So let's say I want to study the ground state of this Hamiltonian, so which has some Ising interaction. It's a quantum Ising model. That's why it's hard, because of this quantum part. So you have the Ising interaction, which aligns the spins along the x direction with a coupling Gij that I control. And then there is a magnetic field that's trying to polarize the spins along y direction. So because sigma y and sigma x don't commit with each other, so this is a quantum system. And when my magnetic field and the spin interactions are comparable to each other, then it's a complicated quantum state, right? Not only that, because of the richness of the interaction, the spin interaction, even when my magnetic field is zero, even the classical Ising model, the ground state is hard, because it's not just a nearest neighbor model or a ferromagnetic model. In fact, finding the ground state configuration of a bunch of Ising spins with arbitrary coupling is an exponentially, it's a hard problem computationally. Okay. So one way we can solve this problem is as follows. So let's say I know how to initialize all my spins along one particular spin direction, right? So let's say I initialize all my spins along y direction. So then I know that my system, by construction, is a good ground state of only this part of the Hamiltonian. So then I turn on the Hamiltonian with this term overwhelming this term, or I can just keep this 0 and have this 1, effectively. And then I slowly turn the magnetic field down, and I'll ramp the interaction part up slowly. And if I do it slowly, then the system will basically follow the ground state of the Hamiltonian, if I do it slowly enough. And eventually, I will stop at whenever I want to stop for some B and some GIJ. And then I look at the spins. I do I detect the spins along the X spaces. And I just, you know, take a look at those pictures, the spin correlations. So that's how this experiment will be done. Now, of course, there are lots of tricky points here, which is I need to make sure that I am in the ground state. And that becomes extremely complicated when the Hamiltonian becomes, you know, crazy. So you have interactions where there is lots of so-called frustrated models, interactions where there are lots of competitions, so that it's very easy to create an excitation. So as I am ramping the Hamiltonian, it's not necessarily guaranteed that I'll be in the ground state. So those are all like problems with this adiabatic quantum simulation method. So let me show you an example of an experiment that that I did when in my PhD a few years back. So again, we are trying to look at the ground state order of this Ising type interaction. So this is a long range Ising interaction where the interaction falls off as roughly 1 over r, 1 over distance. Okay? And they are all antiferromagnetic. Okay? So because they're all antiferromagnetic long range, it's not a, there is some frustration, right? I cannot satisfy all the interactions simultaneously. So what I'm plotting here is, you know, the camera data that I showed, the images. From the images, I can construct, I repeat the experiment many, many times, and I construct this correlation function. So how spin number 1 is correlated to all the other spins. Okay. So this is spin number 1 correlated with spin 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So when the magnetic field is large compared to the average of the Ising couplings, more than 10 times larger, then all the spins are polarized along y direction. And I'm measuring the spins along x direction. So there is no order along x direction. And you see the correlation is pretty much 0. The experimental error bars are roughly the same size here. So pretty much 0. Now I'm doing this adiabatic simulation protocol. So I'm turning down the magnetic field. And now you see, OK, at first you have some anti-correlation appearing with nearest neighbor. It's negative. So if this is positive, this is negative. And as it goes down, you see like this zigzag correlation appearing here, which is a signature of this antiferromagnetic state. So 1 is anti-correlated with 2, correlated with 3, and so on and so forth. But not only that, because I have, you know, access to all the pictures, I can repeat the experiment many, many, many times, and I can collect a histogram of how many times I got this state, how many times I got up, down, state, how many times I got down, up state. So this is an experiment that we did with 10 spins, so it's manageable. There are only 10, 24 states. So we repeated the experiment, you know, some 10,000 or 15,000 times. And here we see, so I have ranked the states, so from 0 to 1023, and this is just some arbitrary ranking, basically binary ranking, right? Spin down is 0, spin up is 1. So this has all 1024 states here. So the red trace that you see is basically, you know, 0 with some fluctuation. It's the state when the magnetic field was very large. So there is no order along the x direction. So you see roughly they're all kind of 0. But then as we turn down the magnetic field, you see out of all those, you know, zoo of states, 2 of them, you know, became like 2 tall towers here. And those are precisely those antiferromagnetic states. And you see, there are some other states here, right, which is not as strong as the ground states, but there are some other states. And you can go back to those, see what those states are. And you will see those are states that are low-lying excited states. So those are states, for example, where you have a domain created between the end spin and the other spins, or between the last 2 spins and the other spins. So this also gives us about what are the, you know, low-lying excitations in this system. Now, we had low-lying excitation because, as I said, doing a fully adiabatic quantum computation is very hard, quantum simulation, because our experiments have to be done within a finite amount of time. Okay. Now, the last part of my talk is we want to go, and the experiment that I'm building at IQC, we basically want to go beyond this still simple kind of interaction where you have a, you know, like a long range, one over distance kind of interaction profile. You want to have access to each and every ion so that you can flip spins, you know, at will. You can flip like spin number 5 or spin number 7 or 2 of them or 3 of them. And you want to have access over the individual interactions, right? So a theorist, like you, can just write down some interaction graph between all these n spins. So n choose 2 couplings. And in my lab, I should be able to do it. Now that's not easy. But in order to do that, we need to have access to this quantum many-body system at the level of individual particles, individual atoms, right? So that's in principle not hard, but in practice, that's pretty hard. So this is to give you an example that came from a Maryland group, Chris Monroe's group, where they built a fully programmable quantum computer, like a mini quantum computer with 5 qubits. And the way they achieved this fully programmable part was by using like a complicated device called multi-channel AOM, where essentially what they're doing is I'm focusing down all the laser beams that I talked about, or the relevant ones at least, onto individual atoms at my will. So I can, you know, flip the spin at number 1, and then I can quickly change, drag that beam to ion number 4, for example, and I do some operation and come back and do all that. So that's one way of doing it. And by just getting access to the individual, you know, atoms, they managed to build this fully programmable 5-qubit quantum computing system. There is another way, so I'm going to try that also, but there is another way, which is by using Fourier holography. And that's something that that at Harvard, where I did my postdoc, we pioneered to use it in the context of this quantum many-body system. So the idea is you don't need an individually focused beam and move it around. You can just create a beam which has the desired profile that you want, right? So it's much like, you know, how we are seeing this slide, right? So I have a picture on my computer, and this is being uploaded to that device over there. And the device basically reorients its small mirrors, that's all the LCD devices that's there. And I'm just projecting the same device here. So let's say in a quantum computation experiment or a Hamiltonian engineering experiment, I want to address the first spin, you know, with some relative amplitude of 1, and the second one with 0.5, and the third with 0.75. So I create a beam, an optics beam, which has exactly that intensity ratio over the entire thing. And I can change that dynamically. So that is something that you need to use this, you know, holography. So essentially what you're doing is, just like how this imaging is done, you need to have control over the wavefront of the light you are using to project onto the ion. And then you can address that. So you can address individual spins, for example. Now, if you want to, the device that, you know, you can do this holography with, it's a very precise device. It's basically a bunch of mirrors, teeny tiny mirrors, 10 microns. It's like a matrix of mirror, and you can turn on and off them individually and control the wavefront of a light almost bit by bit. So it's like Fourier transformation. Your imaging does Fourier transformation, and you are telling the wavefront to, you know, what you want it to look like in the Fourier plane. So you can create all sorts of patterns, and this is so precise. So for example, this is a test setup that we did with a third order Laguerre-Gauss beam, right? And so this is what the beam looks like if you look from the end. And that is created from a normal laser Gaussian beam by sending it to one of those devices, like these projector devices, right? And if you take a scan of the power through the diameter, you see how precise this is. So the red one is the equation for the Laguerre-Gauss mode in log scale in the power, and the black dots are what we measure, what we have created. So you see the precision of such kind of experiment devices, like 10 to the minus 4 level precision in intensity. So this might be the most precise Laguerre-Gauss beam you have ever seen, for example, in reality. Okay? And it is this precision that lets us use this for this very sensitive quantum simulation experiments. So there are 2 ways that I know how to go beyond, you know, this kind of global interactions to like a spin network between spins. And one is do it the complete analog way, which is I showed you this spectrum of different phonon modes. Now, instead of using only one laser beam, you use multiple, and then you basically mix. So I want, you know, like 10% of central mass character and 25% of the third mode character. So you can compute that beforehand for a given interaction, what kind of phonon modes you want your spins to mediate interactions with. And then you just turn on these devices with multiple frequencies. So that's an analog way of doing it. On the other hand, there is a digital way, a Floquet way of doing this, which is you don't care about, so you just have an overall Hamiltonian, which you have engineered using the way I told you. It's like a long-range interaction. Ising couplings fall off as one over R, could be Ising or could be XY in this example. And then you switch the system dynamically. So you turn on this interaction, and you turn on the system for a short amount of time, and then you turn on a bunch of beams which just shift individual spin phases. And you repeat this experiment. So on an average, if you do it right, so this HDQ is this global interaction, and HZ is the individual spin, just you're shifting the phase of individual spins. And you do it a bunch of times, then the average Hamiltonian that you engineer from here, the Floquet Hamiltonian, looks like it has the right kind of interaction shape, essentially. So these are two of the ways. And with this amount of control, you can now ask lots and lots of type of questions, right? So what kind of Hamiltonians you can simulate? Like I showed you quantumizing, but you can do X, Y, and Heisenberg, and look at the phase diagram. You can look at these spin excitations. Another thing is the fact that we can, in principle, flip individual spins, it also lets us measure more complicated spin correlation functions. So for example, I can measure correlation functions between like the X component of spin 1 and Y component of spin 5. That's possible, right? Because I have individual access to the spin rotation. And so it leads to, like, opens up possibilities to explore lots of problems, both in quantum computation, quantum information community, such as, let's say I have a very complicated network, spins connected by an arbitrary interaction. I create an excitation in one point of the network, how fast it propagates through the network, or what's the best way to move information from one node of a network to another node of the network by, let's say, shaping this Hamiltonian dynamically. Or it also opens up questions, you know, to study these quantum phase transitions, you know, high excited states, questions of thermalization, adding disorder in both local magnetic fields, but also in interactions. So kind of look at disordered systems, for example, and many such problems. And thank you for your questions.
So in the last slide, you mentioned that one could simulate quantum phase transitions. I wonder how many spins you could implement with this technique.
Yeah, that's right. So in principle, in this, or not in principle, in practice, in these ion traps, you can trap like 100 ions, no problem. The question is always when you have more and more spins or more and more qubits, how much coherence you have, because now you have all those laser beams interacting and that limits the decoherence. So what I can tell you is the state of the art. In the Maryland group, for example, now they are working with about 26 or about 30 spins, which is still pretty big. It's not a thermodynamic number, but for certain models that could be pretty big already. So I think in next 5 years, I would say, should be able to quantum mechanically, like, with coherence, manipulate about 50-ish, I would say. Going beyond 50 to 100, that would be a lot of technical challenge. But one important thing I would like to point out here, and that's a crucial difference between this kind of quantum simulator versus like a solid state based quantum simulator, is here the core of the quantum simulator, the qubits themselves, are as pristine as you can make, right? This is just given by nature. So all the modifications you are making to increase your coherence time is in the control. So as you are, so you can, make, buy a fancier laser, for example, and increase your coherence time by a little more, which is not the same for if you are using, let's say, a solid state qubit, solid state spin. There your qubit is not perfect. So this is a crucial difference. So, yeah.
What are some of those technical challenges you see cropping up as you go to more and more spins?
Yeah. So a few of them are really, really practical challenges. For example, how long you can hold on to a long chain of 100 ions, for example. So what happens, the vacuum chamber itself is kind of at the limit of the vacuum that you can get at room temperature. So this is, we're talking about 10 to the minus 12 torr kind of vacuum, right? You can't go below this for normal vacuum chambers. So what happens is if you're running this experiment for several seconds or several minutes with a chain of 30 ions, there is a background atom that's flying by, a neutral atom, could be a hydrogen atom, and that's going to be polarized because you have so much charge and will collide with this chain. So this can destabilize the chain and you might lose all the ions and you have to start over again. Okay. So to overcome this problem, you need to increase the vacuum. So you need to go cryogenic. So in several labs now, they are building the vacuum chamber in a cryogenic setup, where in principle you can get up to 10 to minus 16, 10 to minus 17 torr, and then you increase this practical limitation to how long you can work with this from a few seconds or minutes to like a day. That's great. So that's one. So now you have, once you have eliminated this barrier, now there is a second barrier, and which is quite often your simple laser intensity noise. So you are, all the interaction is created by this optical radiation fields, like the laser fields. So if your laser has intensity noise, that's writing noise on all the entire Hamiltonian, essentially. And that's a source of problem, like decoherence. So you try to make sure that you, kill all the intensity and make it as flat as possible. So it's small technical improvements. There is nothing fundamentally wrong. When you have more than, let's say, 100, and you are still using these phonon-mediated modes to do the interaction, what happens is now there is a crowding of phonon mode frequencies, right? So you have your central mass mode, and the next mode is really close and really close and really close, because you have to accommodate like 100 motional modes for this chain of 100 ions. And now you want to, let's say you want to only selectively work with central mass mode to have a long-range interaction. So one way to do that, it would be you don't drive super hard so that you also couple to the next mode, but you have to drive it very slowly and very close to the center of mass mode, your laser bit. Make sense? So you basically have to slow down. So it's again a time scale problem. How long of a coherence time you have in your system?
Is it feasible to do some version of this for gate theories?
Yeah, so it has been, right. So you can have control over the basically the phase of this hopping, which will give you an access to these gauge theories. So there are some models where people have started like a very simple spin model, also in the context of neutral atoms like bosons and fermions, for example. Like a very simple like gauge theory models, starting with Abelian gauge theory and all. I don't know too much about those, but people have started, and some high energy theorists, for example, they are proposing some models that potentially you can do. And I think there is even one very basic experiment where you can do a very basic building block of a model that could be useful to the QED in the beginning and then QCD in the long run.
I'll show you what's that later.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, now let's interact with you again.
Thank you. Thank you.